This is Harry Maguire interviewing David Collins as a part of the University of Victoria Veterans Oral History Program on the 22nd of March, 2019. So, hello, David.
Morning, Harry.
So, I'm going to start with some biographic questions. And just for the record, where were you born?
Actually born in Ottawa, Ontario, but we left there after a year and I essentially grew up in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
And where did you attend school?
School or university?
School.
Grade school in Halifax, high school in Ottawa, Ontario. Okay. We went back to Ottawa.
And then what about university?
Three places. Went to Queen's and Kingston, then Loyola as it became Concordia in Montreal, and finally the University of Durham in the United Kingdom.
And what was your focus?
Initially, it was history and politics, and then I went into business school.
And what year did you join the diplomatic service?
Well, I actually joined the Department of Industry, Trade, and Commerce, as it was then called, in 1976. I formally went to the diplomatic service in 1981.
Okay. What year did you retire from that
post? At the end of 2012.
Okay. Do you have any military service?
Yes, I was a reservist for 16 years in the Navy.
And what trade did you have in
the Navy? We started off in a university training plan during summers. We spent 4 months for 3 summers being trained. I initially started off as an executive branch officer, but time ran out, so I ended up qualifying as a supply and naval control and shipping officer.
And how many languages do you speak?
Fluently two, smatterings of two others.
Which languages are those?
German and Spanish.
So what countries did you work in throughout your career?
Well, Canada, obviously, United States, Poland, Turkey. I was at Brussels, NATO twice. South Korea, Romania, Malaysia, Pakistan, and Kenya. And in several of those, I had multiple postings, or multiple accreditations, as we call it.
Okay. And where was your first assignment?
First foreign assignment was in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Did you have a specialization throughout your career?
Well, I started off largely because of my business background, I guess, and the fact that I joined government through the Department of Trade and Commerce. I was a trade commissioner for the first, say, third half of my career. And then as I developed other skills, as it were, in the political, military arena, I kind of branched out and became a more generalized diplomat, resulting in my ambassadorial appointments.
Okay, so could you tell me a bit about your naval service?
Well, I was probably a classic reservist in the sense that, as I said, I joined a program called the Reserve Officer University Training Program, ROUTP, to differentiate it from the ROTP, which is for regulars. Basically, in my day, the way the Navy ran it, it was the successor to the UNTD program, which had been very popular from the 40s until 1968, when integration occurred. But we were still managed by the Navy, totally, and we went out, we joined a naval division, in my case, HMCS Cataraqui in Kingston, where we trained for 1 or 2 nights a week during the winter, basic parade square stuff and that type of thing. The big training came during the summer when, for 3 years, as I said, 4 months each summer, we went through phase training, basic officer training, phase two, common maritime stuff, and then navigation for phase three. And then for the rest of my time, I went to CFB Borden to train as a supply officer. And I also went and took a course to become a naval control shipping officer, which was convoy organization and that type of thing. That's now changed as part of the naval intelligence branch. So that's changed a bit. Interspersed with all that, we went to sea, of course, in ships to get some sea experience. After I went into full-time work in 1976, I was still able to go on exercises, either naval control or shipping. My largest sea time after my formal training period was 2 months when I joined HMCS Huron in 1977 to go to the UK to participate in the fleet review at Spithead, which was good fun.
And that was the Silver Jubilee?
Silver Jubilee, absolutely. No, it was good, great fun. And then, you know, puttering around 2 weeks there, 3 weeks there. In the end, because by then I joined the Foreign Service, and while I came back to Ottawa and spent another 3 years in HMCS Carleton, which is the Naval Division there, my Foreign Service career was starting to interfere with my Naval career, and I was missing too many Thursday nights, as it were, because I wasn't in the country. So I think the Navy and I decided that perhaps I should just retire. They weren't very accommodating of people like me and the sort of career I did, which is kind of strange because subsequently I was involved in NATO twice. I spent as a seccombat at the Department of National Defense. So I did a lot of stuff that was very complementary to what naval folks would have done. And some of the jobs I had could have been done either by a civilian, as I was, or somebody in uniform. So I always reckoned that the Naval Reserve was a bit short-sighted in curtailing my career when it did.
So did you ever serve in the regular force?
Never
No?
did, never did. I was reservist totally. But as I say, 16 years as a reservist, and if you added up all my bits of active duty, more than weekends and so on, I reckon I have about 2 years of active duty.
So that's including when you went to sea.
Yes, that's
Essentially,
right.
okay.
Yeah, yeah. The 3 summers plus everything else I did over my career.
So what motivated you to join the Navy?
Well, I come from a naval family. My father was a career naval officer, and I guess that was one motivation. Although it's kind of funny looking back on it, because when I came through high school, I had no interest in joining the Naval Reserve as a sailor or anything like that. We looked briefly at me going to RMC, as I recall, but I didn't have a grade 13 math. And at that time, RMC required math because almost everybody went into engineering in those days. So that precluded that. And I wasn't motivated to go to civilian university as an ROTP cadet if I'd been able to make it. But I had no ambition at that stage to become a career military. So when I pitched up at Queen's in Kingston, somehow I was made aware of this ROTP program at the local Naval Division and popped down and signed up. But to be honest with you, and I've thought about this, I can't honestly recall what the motivator was that got me off my ass and down to do it.
But you studied Imperial Naval History,
Yeah,
correct?
I did, I
Yeah.
did. But that came a little later,
Okay, so.
in my first, because I joined the Naval Reserve my first year at
So
Queen's.
that sort of
Yeah, that
influenced
sort
your
of,
decision.
sort of,
Oh,
it was
okay.
mutually supportive on both sides, I guess.
So you left the Naval Reserves and you joined the Foreign Service. What was the motivation for that?
Well,
You said your business background.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to do something international. I had kind of a restlessness, and I always had this interest in doing something overseas. And when I had a chance to join the Foreign Service, which obviously would take one overseas, that kind of fit that bill. Although it was very surprising because when I first went, quote, overseas on a posting, which was the United States, my wife, I was recently married, my wife and I were childless. She was a child of empire in her own right, grown up all over the world, spoke Spanish fluently, French. I spoke Spanish better then than I do now. Had some French, and so we said, we'll go anywhere, Nigeria, take us anywhere. But we got posted to the United States, so that was kind of strange.
So are you, what about French? Did that, with at that time when you joined, did you have to be bilingual?
Not in the way that it subsequently began, but or became. What was always sort of out there was that one needed some French to move along. And unfortunately, the way the government ran French training, to my mind, was you were trained up to whatever level was suitable to your position,
Right.
as opposed to actually trying to get you over the top and really being bilingual.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I entered the executive service of the public service that it became more and more apparent that you needed to have, what the government deemed to be fluency in French. And in fact, by the time I was first appointed an ambassador, which was in 1998, there was then it wasn't legislated, but there was a requirement that all heads of mission had to be fluently bilingual in both languages. And if you weren't, you had to become so before you could go off and take your appointment. I was lucky enough that I was at the next level up when I went off to Romania as first ambassador. But I was always kind of conscious of French out there. And as I said, my early days were in Halifax, where we didn't get any French. By the time I came to Ottawa for high school, there was some French there. I did a little French at university, but not enough really. And it was, not to pat myself on the shoulder, but I was conscious that one needed French. So I used to do Alliance Française courses at the weekend and that type of thing. So in fact, I never actually had any formal French training offered by the government of
Right.
Canada.
So you never had to go to the language school?
No.
Okay.
I did once for a 2 week brush up, just to refresh some stuff when I was in Korea. But I was lucky that I never had to actually go on really full-time French language training, which so many did.
So we ran through the countries that you worked in what countries were you actually head of mission in?
Romania,
okay,
Pakistan, Malaysia, and Kenya.
And then which ones were you accredited to?
Well, in Romania, I was accredited to Moldova and Bulgaria. And in Kenya, I was accredited to Uganda, Burundi, Rwanda, South Sudan, that became a country while I was there. And we also had oversight responsibility for Somalia. But we didn't recognize Somalia at that point, so there was no formal relationship.
So what does accreditation actually mean? Does it mean that you go to these places? Like, how frequently would you have visited Moldova, for example?
Well, it all depended on what was happening, in a sense. And obviously, in an embassy, the head of mission is not the only officer in the embassy.
Right.
In every embassy I had trade people, I had political people, I had defense people and all that. So, consular as well. So the whole team would visit from time to time, and we'd work out a schedule. And, you know, occasionally a trade guy would go to Moldova, for example, would do some consular work if he was there, if there was somebody in jail or whatever, and make a visit. But in my case, I would say I went to Moldova perhaps 3 times a year. Moldova 20 years ago was still emerging from post-communism, trying to find itself, desperately poor, mm-hmm. not too sure what it wanted to be. It was very much controlled by Russian elements still, and that exists today to an extent. I spent a lot more time in Bulgaria, which I thought had some potential both commercially and politically, because at the time both Romania and Bulgaria were aspiring to join NATO and the European Union. So countries like Canada were supporting them in terms of their security sector reform efforts, defense reform, and that type of thing. So I, in fact, would go down to Bulgaria once a month, consciously, because one of the hangovers from the old Cold War days, in missions like Romania and in Bulgaria, NATO ambassadors used to have a monthly meeting. And that carried on even after independence came. So I would go down to Bulgaria, Sofia, the capital, every month to participate in, you know, physical presence, the NATO ambassadors meeting there.
So you already answered this, but did you work with any multilateral organizations?
Yeah, in my case, I had almost no, until the end of my career, when I was the permanent representative of Canada to two UN organizations in Kenya, UNEP, the Environment Program, and Habitat, which did, you know, housing and that sort of thing. My main involvement was NATO, and two experiences there. Well, actually more than two, but, well, in a diplomatic sense, the first one, I served for 3 years in the Canadian delegation to NATO in Brussels, and then a few years later I came back for 2 years and worked on the staff as a member of the International Secretariat, as Defense Partnership and Cooperation Director. But my NATO experience started a little earlier than that. Two things. When I was in Huron for the Silver Jubilee Review in 1977, in those days a lot of ships were sailing the Atlantic kind of in support of NATO.
Right.
We weren't formally part of then the Standing Naval Force, but we exercised with a U.S. ship going over, that sort of thing, all in a NATO context. And I was also for 3 years the naval member of the Canadian delegation to the Inter-Allied Confederation of Reserve Officers. In French, it's CIOR. And it met in Brussels once a year and elsewhere in a capital in NATO each summer, typically. So that kind of got me involved in the NATO scene earlier than even my posting was. So, and then when I was in the Department of National Defense, I had a job which was very NATO-orientated. And even in foreign affairs, I spent 2 years working in our Defense Programs Bureau, running bilateral defense agreements with NATO allies. So I had a lot of actual NATO experience. And that, in fact, when I look back on it, that sort of experience, coupled with my naval experience, helped me bridge into the political military environment, which no doubt broadened my perspective and got me to places like Romania and Pakistan, where arguably a trade commissioner might not have gone.
Right. So what kind of work did you do when you were in Brussels?
Well, the first time it was armaments cooperation, defense production, that type of thing. We had a position in the delegation which, for want of a better expression, was kind of the defense trade commissioner. So we helped Canadian companies trying to secure jobs within NATO or on common funded programs elsewhere in the alliance. And we also had an active program of, as I say, armaments cooperation, where Canada would participate with other allies in in common development of frigates, helicopters, a lot of electronic programs like airborne early warning and that type of thing. So I was the point man there. Ironically, in that job, I spent much more time working with our Department of National Defense than I did with the Department of External Affairs, as it was, even though I was an external affairs officer in the delegation.
Okay. How did the fact that you had prior military service influence, and just your reserve service, let's say, influence the way that you interacted with defense personnel when you were serving as a civilian?
Right, right. Well, I had my own experience, of course, in the Navy. And,
right.
I was always keen, so I was more involved in an in-depth way than, say, some of my peers who kind of looked at it either as a summer job or just they were birds of passage coming through and that sort of thing. But having grown up in a naval household as well, of course, and my father was an admiral, so I had a fairly good exposure to the whole scene growing up.
Right.
And obviously I didn't reject it, so that kind of bridged into my own naval career. And I guess what it gave me, and I found this both in the delegation and when I worked in D&D later and when I went back to NATO as Director of Defense Partnership, I had some credibility with the military. And I could relate to them, we talked the same language, and so I wasn't viewed as a foreign affairs outsider with no knowledge or interest. So I was always accepted, I thought,
right.
On an equal basis. And the military, of course, are always a bit suspicious of outsiders. And in our Canadian experience, there are a lot of people in the Foreign Service who haven't had military experience, mm-hmm. are anti-military, not pro-defense, for all sorts of reasons. So in my case, I was lucky I had that background, which gave me currency and some influence with military folks.
Oh yeah, I should ask you quickly, what rank did you rise to in reserve?
Lieutenant commander.
Okay. So you felt you had a better understanding of the military?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was just getting on with people and understanding what motivated them and talking their talk a bit. And, you know, because they knew... Funny enough, I think when I first went to defense, you know, people knew that I had a naval background because my father was quite prominent. Not that it affected me adversely, but it gave me a little cred there, so to speak. But also because of my own military background, which people knew. And, you know, when you've been on a ship in the middle of the Atlantic, it gives you some experience and some commonality of background and that sort of thing, which was useful.
And so that was missing from... most people that worked in external affairs.
Yeah. And not to say it, I don't want to blanket my former colleagues and say they were all anti-defense, whatever, but some dust didn't have an understanding of how the military operated.
Right.
And, you know, the reputation of the military and sort of the wider Foreign Service was that they were, you know, order-bound, too unimaginative, kind of inward-looking, not outward-looking, and that type of thing.
So how would you assess the ability of diplomats and military envoys to work cooperatively? Sort of a textbook style question, but...
there are two levels, because obviously, you know, in Ottawa, one of the challenges I always found in the military was that working in defense with military folks is that a lot of them didn't come to Ottawa until they were relatively senior, lieutenant colonel or colonel equivalents and up. And so, you know, they missed a lot of the blow-by-blow that younger officers would have had watching how the system worked, the staff worked, how Ottawa played, the role of the center, where departments fit in with the center, and that type of thing.
What do you mean by the center?
Center was the Prime Minister's office,
okay.
Privy Council office, the Department of Finance. What we used to call downtown.
So the upper bureaucrats.
Upper bureaucrats. Well, the people who were in Ottawa the whole time and who knew the game in and out. A lot of the military lacked some of that experience, so they didn't necessarily play the game as well as they might have. So you got the relationship there. And I always found, actually, in our Department of National Defense, that the relationship between the military and civilians in the Department of Defense was not bad. I mean, there was tension. And there's been a lot written about the role of the deputy minister versus the chief of defense staff and who's primus inter pares and all that sort of thing. And there were obviously tensions because the civilians control the money and the military want the money to spend and do stuff and obtain equipment. So there was some tension there, but because our Department of National Defense employed so many retired officers and others, again, there was an understanding. So it worked better than it might do in some other countries like the United Kingdom, where you don't have quite as many ex-military in the civil service, in their MOD, in my view. So you've got that experience. Between foreign affairs and defense, then external affairs, there was a bit of a tension because, of course, a lot of people in external affairs were looking at trying to ban the bomb and, you know, de-arm and all this sort of stuff. And the military necessarily weren't all that keen on that type of thing. So there was a bit of a misunderstanding there. And I don't think on an intellectual level, and I'm not saying that anybody's brighter than anybody else, but on an intellectual level, there may have been a bit of a mismatch between external affairs and national defense. So that's kind of in Ottawa. When we went abroad in embassies, where all the embassies I served in, bar one, I think, had a defense attaché, either resident or non-resident. And depending on the individual involved and his or her interest in being part of the wider country team in a mission, they were accepted and were very much part of the team and could provide useful support both to the ambassador and to the wider mission because, you know, defense guys are kind of can-do people. They're good on emergency preparedness sort of thing, you know, emergency measures, crisis management, that type of thing. And once people got to know each other on a personal level, which in a mission you do, because most of our missions are pretty small, you understood what they brought to the party, you appreciated them, you had a beer with them, and that type of thing. And that probably worked out much better, in a sense. But again, a couple of times I had my defense attachés come to me and say, oh, I'm glad you have some military background, because a lot of ambassadors don't, like most these days don't, and they don't quite understand what defense is about, and they may or may not be interested. And one guy, in fact, told me, who'd been an attaché three times before he came to me, he said, I can tell when I first meet a head of mission within 5 minutes whether he or she is going to be interested in my program. And the way it works overseas with other departments in embassies, while the ambassador's the manager of the whole shebang and responsible for everything, each department reports on its own net back to its department. Now, of course, information is meant to be shared, and it normally is. But a defense attaché in an embassy abroad is tasked with certain specific things on which he reports back to defense in the armaments field, in the policy field, the operations, intelligence, of course. You know, a smart ambassador looks at the talent he has in a mission and is able to tap into it as he needs to develop his own thinking on a relationship with a country or a group of countries.
So how many in the offices you worked in, how many military would there typically be besides the attaché? Did it depend on the country?
Well, typically the profile in a mission was a defense attaché, either a lieutenant colonel or a colonel, and then a sergeant as a sort of support person. And often the sergeants were from the intelligence community. Some were from the admin side, you know, supporting that way. In Kenya, we actually ran a military training program in a regional support training center. So in addition to the colonel I had in the mission, plus his sergeant, we had two majors, regular force majors, on attachment in Kenya.
So they were
to
training
the support center. They were training others, yeah.
Okay.
It was a regional training center.
Okay.
And they kind of supported the center. But we actually brought in training teams from Canada to support courses as well. Mm. But we had two permanent guys there. So, I mean, the footprint in these missions is never large. But in most of our missions, teams aren't big anyway. So, you know, when I was in Poland, for example, 100 years ago, I was the sole trade commissioner in the embassy.
So how many locals would be hired in most of these, with, like, for administrative support staff, would you bring in Canadians, or?
Well, what we try to do, you know, for those jobs, I mean, it sounds a bit divisive, but we used to have what we call Canada-based staff, CBS, and locally engaged staff, LES. And the LES did all the stuff that had interface with the local authorities because of language often. They did a lot of the more common admin stuff. But there were also local officers as well, commercial officers, program officers, and consular service and that type of thing. What we tried to do with some success was to offer locally engaged jobs to spouses of Canadians. The problem with that was, unless you were in London or Zurich or Bern or wherever, where salaries were pretty good, often in countries like Pakistan or even Korea, the pay was not very good, and it was not up to Canadian standards. So a lot of spouses said, I'm not going to work for peanuts, which is what we, well, we didn't pay peanuts, but we paid the local wage for local staff,
right,
which in a number of cases was much less than what we would pay a Canadian person.
Are there any specific instances that you can talk about where you thought that the military and the civilian staff worked particularly well together or not? Well, I mean, those are two separate questions, but how about we'll start with the positive one? Like, do you think that you can point to one that you thought, yeah, we're working well together?
For example, when I was in the Department of National Defense, I was running a bureau dealing with industry and international programs. And one of the programs we inherited was defense marketing. At that time, external affairs becoming foreign affairs was getting out of direct support to marketing of defense products. And of course, that's topical now with things like the Labs, the Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, at that time, when I was there in the mid-90s, the Canadian Patrol Frigate was coming on stream. And the frigate design was interesting, and a lot of the systems on board the ship were interesting too. So we cooperated with the Navy particularly to set up a marketing program which would see patrol frigates deployed overseas on their normal roles, but they would also pop into places that might be interested in purchasing the systems that our companies had devised and so on. You know, combat systems, navigation systems, that type of thing. And that worked very well. I mean, the Navy was fully interested and cooperative, and hardly any friction there at all. And often the companies would chip in some money for the marketing stuff in place and that type of thing. That's one example. On the more negative side, occasionally you would get policy differences, things like disarmament type of thing, or how aggressive Canada should be in deploying troops abroad, you know, the peacekeeping sort of issue. One thing I always recall, and I think it's still in play, that the military wants to do stuff. I mean, they're there, and you can only train so much. You can only send troops to Wainwright, Alberta to train. They're ready, like a coiled spring sort of thing, and they want to go and do things, as we're now doing in Ukraine, Latvia, Iraq, and type of thing. So there was always a pressure, perhaps, from the military to push forward and say, let's offer up and do things.
Yeah.
And occasionally, you know, the military wouldn't appreciate, or in their zeal just to get on with it, wouldn't look at the wider nuances of foreign policy interests, both in terms of how we related to allies and allied interests, or what Canada's own interests were in pursuing things. For example, I don't know for sure, but I should think that given the coalition of the willing that was formed by George Bush and Tony Blair to go to war in Iraq,
right,
our military would have been ready to deploy, as we did some years later in Afghanistan. Of course, the government of the day, led by Prime Minister Chrétien, was dead against going to Iraq, because I don't think we ever believed that there were weapons of mass destruction out there, etc., etc. So Chrétien took what I think was a principled and quite brave decision not to engage us militarily in Iraq. It wasn't communicated very well to the wider public, of course, but the decision, I think, was sound, and history will reflect favorably on that decision. But I suspect the military were pushing for some involvement, largely because they wanted to support our major ally, the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you want to be part of the team, you've got to play in the team occasionally. So there would have been some tension there.
So in one of my previous interviews, the subject of the interview made a statement that I found interesting. He said that in his experience, the military and foreign affairs, they work well together operationally, but where there's disagreement, it's usually on policy. So is that something you would agree with?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But the other thing, too, is once the policy is agreed, the military are very good, salute and can do, and get on with implementing whatever's agreed or not. Mm-hmm. One of the things, for example, we used to, there's still, I'm sure, going on, we used to have biannual committee meetings with foreign affairs and defense about ships visits. Now, every mission overseas wanted a ship's visit because ships flew the flag, they were visible. You get ashore, the crew would play soccer with the local Navy, whatever. The ship was a good platform to have a cocktail party on board. You get local influencers to participate in that sort of thing. And the Navy or the military would come through, funny enough, the civilian side of D&D to say, hi, this is the ops program for the year. The ships can go A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Which countries of foreign affairs have a priority on for them to pop in to make a visit. Mm-hmm. So you'd have a bit of a wrangle about that. It was all pretty good-natured. But occasionally, you know, foreign affairs would want a ship to go somewhere where the Navy just didn't really see a point or the support wasn't there for it. But that was, as I say, a bilateral sort of review of it all.
So what about attitudes toward... You sort of alluded to this, talking about the... Blair and George Bush is going into Iraq, but do you think that the military was maybe, and this could depend on the service too, but do you think there was more of a willingness to do things with the Americans than perhaps, is there an anti-American attitude in some elements of the foreign service, do you think, or?
No, I don't think so. It's funny, if you look at it again in a defense concept, ever since the Second World War, when we started to wean ourselves off support from the Brits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, up into the mid-50s, several of our services, especially the Navy, still sent officers to train with the Brits. But from the Second World War on, I think we realized that our strength was continental defense, and that meant getting closer to the Americans in all sorts of things, equipment compatibility, training compatibility, and that sort of thing. So... I don't think either on the political side, foreign affairs side, or the military side, anyone would argue that our best friend around town is the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some policy directions and decisions in the United States that we don't support. For example, Canada, unlike Australia, never went into Vietnam.
Right. Yeah.
Another example. Yeah. Despite the fact we've been on the International Control Commission in Vietnam before the war started... accelerating, and we were trying to keep the peace, so to speak. We got out of there when it got out of hand, and the Americans took over from the French, essentially, to try and kick the communists out. But we didn't see that as our fight in that sense, and didn't want to get embroiled in it, whereas, I say, Australia did. Britain provided support, but never sent troops either. So there are areas where, there's policy dissidence, I guess, but I don't think there's any issue that most would understand that we need to keep pretty close to the United States.
So, and that would be the same throughout the services. Yeah. So the Air Force has been, I think, accused of being more pro-American, at least in some of my previous interviews. But you don't agree with that, or?
There is a differentiation between the services. I mean, don't forget the Air Force. You know, if you look at Continental Defense, they're totally integrated with through NORAD,
right?
Of course, in flying to protect us from Soviet bombers and anybody else who might come. So the relationship between our Air Force and the United States Air Force has been very close for a long time. Mm-hmm. The old joke used to be that there'd always every spring there'd be some sort of joint. Exercise down in Florida, and funnily enough, all our senior officers would go down to observe it carrying sets of golf clubs. Now, I'm not suggesting that that was the reason for the exercise, but again, it was all about building relationships. And I think the Air Force did pretty well in being close up with the USAF.
So, and I mean, this is generally speaking, but there's not a lot written in my personal opinion about the interaction between military and foreign affairs overseas, at least in a Canadian context. But there's one British author that I read who made sort of a sweeping generalization, saying that part of the problem between if there was any tension, it was usually because the military would send in people, and of course this is in a British context, that were at the end of their career to be attachés. Do you think that's true in Canada as well? Do you think it's sort of a final post before retirement in some cases?
I think the Americans, for example, run a system whereby at some stage relatively early in their career, they can become foreign area specialists, and they go into kind of a career stream as an attaché. And by and large, if you're any good at that, you can rise up to full colonel,
right,
and occasionally brigadier, nothing more. But of course, they're so large, they've got enough people and enough opportunities to accommodate them. Mm-hmm. We're so small that if you rise to full colonel in our military, that's actually deemed to be a very good career. Because from there, the pyramid becomes very direct, and to go on to general, brigadier, and above, quite difficult, because there's just relatively few. So if you become a full colonel in our system, you're not doing badly at all. We went through a period where, what you've just said, defense attaché job was often given as a last appointment, either to somebody who was not going to be further promoted, but who was a good guy or gal and who deserved a little something at the end of the career. Or, sadly, in some cases, people who didn't fit very well anymore, and they were sent overseas where they could do little harm, relatively speaking. Now, in the mid-90s, we went through a system, consciously. Margaret Thatcher went through this, too. She went somewhere and found some defense attaché who was asleep at the switch. She said, God damn it, we've got to stop sending these deadbeats abroad. We went through that as well. I don't know if there was a result of any one incident. But we went through a period in the mid-90s for two cycles at least, where we would find, you know, up-and-coming officers and promote them and send them off. You know, the joke used to be, Bloggins, hi, it's your career manager here. You're being promoted colonel. Oh, great, thank you. Yeah, your first posting is defense attaché Warsaw. What? And, you know, if you're an up-and-comer in the military, these defense attaché jobs were considered dead ends. Mm-hmm. You want to be operational, you wanted to be in an A job, and so on. Attaché jobs were always considered B jobs.
So the working rank for an attaché is colonel?
Yeah, we have a funny system. A lot of our attachés are colonels while so employed. So they're acting colonels. We do have some where we have sent proper colonels, but a lot of them are acting colonels. But to go back to my point about trying to revive the program a little bit, I had two attachés during my time in Warsaw during the Cold War. Both were Air Force officers, one Army TAC Air, the other was an Air Force Technical Officer. They both came to Warsaw on promotion to colonel, and they both ended up as brigadiers in subsequent career development. So they were the bright sparks coming in. We kind of slipped away from that again, and again looked at opportunities for deserving officers to serve. But what's changed a bit is that we identify officers earlier to become attachés. The military is pretty good, in my view, in terms of career management. They know who's going to make it, who's not going to make it early on. And they're more honest than, say, the regular civil service is in saying to Lieutenant Colonel Bloggins, hi, you're a good guy, but you know the competitive field is such, you're not going to make colonel. Mm-hmm. What would you like to do? And often, so if a guy or a gal does that at, say, 45, 47, they have about 8 years left of doing other things. So often they will then go into the attaché program. And if they prosper at that, they can have two or three jobs as attachés. And do a decent job and that sort of thing. So they're not deadbeats in any way. They're just not quite at the promotion cusp. I had a naval colleague of mine who I sailed with 100 years ago. He was a naval captain. And when he had his annual chat with his career manager, he was told, well, John, sorry, you're not going to make Commodore. What would you like to do? And he said, I'd like an attaché job. And he was a good guy, just wasn't going to make Commodore. And he went off to be an attaché.
So how did the Cold War affect the way that the military interacts with civilians? Do you think that there was a NATOist, sort of like an Atlanticist sort of bias in the 80s, and that's changed now? Like, do you think there's been more focus on Asia now than there would have been in the 80s?
Yeah, I think if you look at, obviously both political and military elements respond to a threat level.
Right.
And during the Cold War, Russia and its allies posed an immediate threat. So when you were overseas, I was in Poland, which was a Warsaw Pact country, the military attaché we had was thick as thieves with other NATO attachés in town, mm-hmm. and they were deeply involved in intelligence work of one sort or another. No other way about it. When you start looking at, you know, after 89, when the wall came down and things opened up a bit and so on, we went into a relative period of tranquility, mm-hmm. as it were, with Russia and the former Soviet bloc countries, you know, the peace dividend and all that sort of thing. And then as we started shifting a bit and looking around the world at what's of more interest, we had our modest pivot to Asia as well. Yeah. Which a lot of people have been arguing for forever. You know, Canada is a Pacific country, and we've ignored a lot of things in Asia, now the Indo-Pacific, as it's called, to our peril. So we rebalanced our fleet a little bit from the East Coast to the West Coast, put a couple more ships out here. We have a submarine operating from here again. And, of course, in, you know, spring to 2018, 2019, we've got kind of a double challenge, the rise of China and its interest in hegemony in the South China Sea and mm-hmm. the area around there. Russia, of course, thumping around, trying to exert its authority again. I think after Crimea, people realized that Russia wasn't going to be our friend. There were a lot of people who gave Russia a bit of a benefit of the doubt, you know, saying, well, you know, they have challenges and all this, but I think after Crimea, it was pretty persuasive that they have other interests. One little anecdote you might be interested in. When I was in NATO the second time, my group ran the NATO-Russia Council, which is part of the partnership arrangements that NATO has, and which still goes on. Doesn't meet very frequently, but it's still there. But in my time, we in NATO, I was part of the defense group, and we were largely a civilian group. Diplomats, ex-defense officials, supported by the military. So we would go to the NATO Council, NATO-Russia Council meetings, and our chair would be a civilian. I did it a couple times. My boss did it a couple times, too. On the Russian side, they were all generals, mm-hmm. supported by a couple of diplomats. So, you know, there was an absolute example of how the Russians viewed dealing with NATO. They saw us as a military alliance, and they dealt with that in a military way. We always took NATO to be a political military alliance, and we fronted it with civilians.
Over your time, how have you perceived, do you think there's been a shift in the way that foreign affairs people look at the military and vice versa? And so that's to say, early on in your career, there would have been people that had Second World War, Korean War experience, and therefore a greater understanding of the military, and that's no longer the case today. So how do you think that's
well, you're right, and even for those who, you know, when I joined the public service, there were certainly World War II veterans still around, and of course Korean veterans as well, yeah. And most of us had fathers or uncles who served in the Second World War. As you say, that's all disappearing. And the awareness of what the military is all about, apart from the surge that occurred during our time in Kandahar, mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, and the surge of emotion that still occurs on November the 11th, the wider understanding of the military and what it's meant to do is not very great. And I think one of the indicators, of course, of that is when you look at how the federal government funds programs in Canada, I would not say the military is underfunded per se, although we have real problems on procurement at right. the moment, of course. Yeah. But the bottom line is, in Canada, there are no votes in defense. So the government feels no need to go over the top to either increase the military in a substantive way.
What do you mean by no votes in defense? But
well, if you're looking at issues such as healthcare, education, and so on, where, you know, they resonate with the people, they directly affect
right.
people's
yeah.
livelihoods and
yeah.
so on. You know, in accelerating the procurement of the new Canadian surface combatant is not going to cheer up your average
right.
Canadian.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, nobody can campaign on that and get a vote for it.
Yeah.
Even, ironically, in cities like Victoria,
yeah.
Which is a military town in part, you know, the NDP here aren't particularly pro-military. They have other priorities for their programming. So it has changed a bit, but it's basically just about knowledge and understanding and familiarity. And when you're not familiar with something, you tend to ignore it or dismiss it out of hand as not being important, which is not true.
So do Foreign Service people, do they have any training about the military before you take one of these posts? Is there any real understanding? I mean, you obviously had it because of your reserve service.
Well, an awareness, yes.
Yeah. But there's, you just think that there's a lack of, is it education about the military or just an unwillingness to learn?
I honestly think, I don't think it's considered a priority. You know, in heads of mission programs, we used to get a guy come over from DND for half an hour to talk about defense policy and what they were interested in. Very little about defense operations, very little about how to deal with defense attaches, for example. The best example, I suppose, of any of that is the personal interest that someone might take. You know, anywhere I went where there was a defense interest, I would always go and call on people at National Defense as part of my series of out calls. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure every ambassador did that, but that was my own interest and my own understanding of how it all played. But it's a bit unregulated and not systematized in any way, which is a bit disappointing.
So it's very much an individual...
Yeah, and it's kind of ad hoc.
Yeah. How much effect did the changes in government have on that relationship?
Well, I have to say, in my experience, you know, a lot of governments talk a good line about pro-defense and sort of the Harper government was a case in point. They had the aura of being very pro-defense, pro-military. In the end, they didn't really deliver any much than anybody else did, except good words and that type of thing. I remember I was serving in our delegation at NATO in 1994 when Kim Campbell was Minister of Defense. She came to the delegation for a NATO meeting, and I think she just declared her interest in becoming leader of the Conservative Party and after Mulroney. And so she was there, you know, a chirpy defense minister and kind of presenting herself as a leader of the nation and that type of thing. So that was interesting. But from an actual on the coal face point of view, governments changing didn't really affect the reality much at all. You know, during the time in the mid-90s, after Kim Campbell lost the election, of course, the Liberals came in and started cutting some things again and so on. And traditionally, where the Conservatives have been kind of status quo in defense in many ways, the Liberals have been looking to take a peace dividend every time and either cut if they could or just not reinvest where they should have. And we're seeing some of that today with the long extended lead times on defense procurement programs. I mean, all governments tend to put to the right as much as they can these big, big sums they need to spend on defense.
Right. Okay.
And even the Liberals now, running a deficit type of government, they're not really willing to spend the bucks now as that they should to get on with stuff. It's a slow process.
So, as I should ask you, because of your naval background, how did getting the Royal Navy... Royal Canadian Navy designation back to that. Did you like that or what did
well,
because unification is a topic that's come up quite a few times in the literature about military attitudes towards the Canadian government.
Yeah, of course, if you remember the Navy, there are a bunch of, you know, rebellious admirals around who didn't like what Hellyer was doing, and many of them quit early. Things carried on as they do. Frankly, my sense is when the, you know, rebadging the RCAF and the RCN, giving them back the old titles, I don't think it really bothered a lot of people serving one way or the other. Mm-hmm. For example, when I joined the Naval Reserve until I retired, I never served in either the Royal Canadian Navy or the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve. I was the Canadian Navy, part of the Canadian Armed Forces. Now, people tell me that if I'm designating myself, I'm now Lieutenant Commander David Collins, RCN, retired.
Yeah.
Well, I never served in the RCN, per se. So I don't really think, in my sense, is that people, especially younger sailors and so on, really got charged about it.
Mm.
But I will say that I think in terms of service identity, meaning less maybe to individuals, but for the service as a whole, it makes more sense to have the RCN as a separate service because people understand it is a, in as much as we have separate services, it is a defined unit of the component of the regular force.
So do you think that the foreign affairs people would generally understood these things, or are they not?
Well, they might understand whether they care much or not. I don't think. No, unless you're involved in it, it's...
So was there any service identity overseas in the embassies? Like, so there was... You would have a commander or a colonel... Or sorry, what rank for the Navy would it have been in?
Yeah, a naval captain.
So how many... Like, did all services... Did they serve together overseas, or was it...
Well, for example, when I was at the Canadian delegation to NATO, we had a tri-service thing there because we had a joint delegation with the military representative and the political side, which was the permanent representative ambassador to NATO. So in our joint delegation, we'd have a mix of all services because typically they had a naval guy, an Air Force guy, and an Army guy, a logistics guy, and then a couple colonels who could be anything. But in terms of in smaller embassies, I had a naval guy in Romania, which didn't make a whole bunch of sense because Romania didn't really have much of a navy. I had an army engineer in Malaysia, Pakistan, Kenya. I had army colonels. Mm. So it's who's available.
So what do you think needs to be said about the relationship between military and civilian foreign affairs people? That's a pretty broad question, but I mean, take your time.
I guess if I were looking back at it, I just wish that there was enough interest on both sides' part to reach out a bit more and to create better understanding as to who people are and what they do and that type of thing, and not wait till you're thrown together at some mission overseas. But the reality of Ottawa is that, departments get kind of stovepiped. You're running your own business. Days are long, days are busy. You don't have much time for that type of outreach, in a way. When I first did defense stuff in the Department of Foreign Affairs, we had a Defense Programs Bureau. And we had a sort of an analogous bureau over in defense. So we spent a lot of time together. So at that level, we got to know each other quite well. In the same way, the defense relations people in the Security Bureau of Foreign Affairs do a lot with the policy shop in national defense. So again, some people relate and that type of thing. But in the broader context, people carry on and just are kind of unaware of what's happening.
So
I'm not saying that's bad, it's just how it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked about the criticism sort of from a military perspective of civilians, but what was really the big, in your opinion, the criticism that they, foreign affairs people had of the military? Was it like they were unwilling to...
I guess, they didn't understand the wider picture.
Yeah.
The policy picture.
Yeah.
They were so focused on... ultimately expressing military force. It's kind of odd because, to just digress for a sec, when you look at ministries of defense, and we have an integrated military defense with our military.
Mm-hmm.
Some places have a separate military defense and a separate military headquarters. Ours are combined.
Okay.
So we have one together. We have had since integration. And it's always amazed me a little bit because in some cases, and I can speak a bit about the British systems. I know a lot of people have worked in the MOD there. For some of them, the fact that the military exists is kind of inconsequential or by the way. The real work's done by civilians on the policy side and all this. And the military is kind of part of a toolkit that can be used or not as required. My view, maybe because of my background, was that, in fact, in a combined Ministry of Defense, the whole civilian establishment in the ministry, elsewhere, in a base, whatever, they're there to support the military. Now, yes, you do it cooperatively and you have mutual interests and you sort it out, but I've never actually accepted the view that the military is some sideshow while the civilians really run it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in our system, there's civilian control of the military, no question about that.
Yeah.
But to discharge or dismiss the military as being just a an inconsequential adage or addition is a bit strange to me. But again, it's just interest and so on. A lot of people just have no interest in defense matters.
So what about, you said about the British system, so how is that different in the MOD, like criticism of Whitehall?
Well, there still is a huge division in the MOD between the military side, Chief of Defense Staff, and what he runs on the service side, and the MOD civilians. And as I say, in my experience, a lot of MOD civilians, especially higher policy people, have had never any experience in the military themselves. Yeah. We're getting more and more like that now. Very few of our senior civilians in our DND have had direct military experience. Exception is the guy who's running ADM Materiel, who was an engineer, rear admiral in his day. But on the policy side, and the associate deputies, none of them have any military experience.
So why is it? Because, I mean, why is that? From an outsider, it would appear to make sense to have some people with military experience running at the senior levels. But is that not a motive? Like, what's the real motivation for putting these people?
Well, I think actually at the the way we've started running our higher civil service in the last 20 years is this view that senior managers can be good at anything. So you can put anybody in any job, and if they're a good manager and a good civil servant, they'll be able to make out, so to speak. There may also be a view as well that if you had too many ex-military in the senior levels of a defense ministry, it's a bit nepotistic and a bit too cozy. You know, people want to be part of it. In the same way, one could argue, we've had a couple of examples in Canada where prime ministers have put retired military officers in charge of defense. We have one now. Whether putting a retired reserve colonel or lieutenant colonel in charge of the defense ministry is the right approach, I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
The Tories did it with a chap called Alan MacKinnon years ago, who was a retired major. He wasn't a very successful defense minister. History will judge whether the current minister is any good or not, I guess.
So what sort of personalities do you think, in terms of working overseas, what sort of personality do you think is that makes a good ambassador or a good military attaché?
Well, of course, the whole thing in part is about relationship building.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're there to report on events in the country you're accredited to and to represent your own country's interests to that country, you need to be outgoing enough that you can build relationships and carry on a reasonable discussion with the people you meet.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, we often send people who are introverts, who aren't very good at reaching out, don't understand how to use representation, i.e. entertainment properly and that sort of thing. And again, from a country point of view, we don't seem to care too much about that. We don't encourage people or train them how to do this type of stuff. It's a bit of hit and miss. If it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, well, it doesn't matter too much.
Yeah, so it is. It seems very dependent on the individual.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it isn't any, some people often say that, anybody can make a job better than it was, whether they're interested, whether they've got the right background. If you're the right person, you can go into a job and improve on it. That's true sometimes, but not all the time. But you've got to have an interest, too. And, for example, one hopes that if we're sending defense attachés overseas, they have an interest in, A, being a defense attaché, and wanting to go overseas. I often think sometimes in our foreign service now, because there's so many challenges about putting people overseas, spousal employment, families, education, housing, and all the rest, some of our people occasionally go overseas reluctantly. In my vintage, most of us were keen as mustard to get overseas, because that's why we joined the Foreign Service.
Yeah. Well, what do you think we should talk about now? Do you have any thoughts on that, or anything you would like to go back to? We're at an hour, I guess. We could.
Yeah, no. The only thing I'd say is that I think we need to be a little more professional in how we manage this stuff. Certainly in the foreign affairs side, we need to improve our human resources management system. We're going through a period now where we're veering away from a career foreign service on the basis that You know, accepting anybody from anywhere to send them abroad once for a posting is okay, and that they'll do an okay job. I don't think that works out too well.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, when I joined the Trade Commissioner Service, and it was a service of people who became career Foreign Service Trade Commissioners.
Mm-hmm. Now they just pick and choose.
Yeah, from anywhere in government.
Okay,
yeah. For example. And one of the policies of the current government, of course, and I don't denigrate it, is a decision by the Prime Minister that all heads of mission will be 50% women, gender balance, which is fine. Well, we're not quite at this stage yet where the Department of Foreign Affairs can generate enough qualified, interested women who will accept head of mission assignments. There's some, but not enough. So, A, we end up digging deeper into the system and putting people who are more junior. They may have potential, but they lack experience to fill these jobs. Or what's happening, too, going more outside the Foreign Service to find people in other government departments to fill jobs. I'm not saying that's wrong necessarily, but it's a different take on it. And it doesn't allow you to build the expertise of people who, you know, improve their abilities to serve abroad and work abroad. And what you find, too, is, of course, a lot of people who are in the Foreign Service, I want to go to London, Paris, Bonn, or Berlin, Washington, New York, Geneva. There aren't too many people who want to go to Kenya or to Islamabad or even to Seoul, Korea. So it's a real management job, and I'm not too sure we've gripped that properly. The military are a bit better because still in their culture, you know, you sign up, and basically if the military order you to go somewhere, by and large, you do it.
Right.
With reasonably good spirits. But that's changing a bit, too, because a lot of people have families who don't want to move and so on. So the demographic reality has changed a lot in the last 30 years.
Yeah, so on demographics, what about regionalism in Canada? Like, for example, like bilingualism, obviously, more people from Quebec. Does that play a role?
Or? Well, if you'll recall, you know, years ago, the you know, merit lists in the military included bilingualism, and certain people had to be bilingual, and often they would go down a merit list till they found somebody who was bilingual. So people who were bilingual, who weren't necessarily as professionally capable, were promoted over others who didn't have French and that sort of thing. We never did that consciously in the Foreign Service, in part perhaps because we had a lot of capable French-speaking people. And there was a conscious effort, too. I'm not too sure if it's still in play, of the duality of Canada. You would actually have a number of Québécois, not just French-speaking. I mean, I speak French, but I'm not Québécois.
Right.
So you want to have the representation of Canada abroad, reflecting what the cultural diversity of the country is. And that, of course, is changing hugely now. In fact, really our Quebec friends, Québécois friends, are losing out a bit to other ethnicities that Canada reflects. So the whole scene is changing very much.
Do you think it's affected the relationship with the, in terms of the military at all? Or?
No, I mean, one of the problems, the military is trying hard, of course, to diversify. But a lot of new Canadians, especially, come from countries where police, military are not friends of the folks.
Yeah.
So they're not naturally inclined to join. And I think we're going to have to open up the recruiting to, you know, attract people who we might not have otherwise attracted. I don't want to say lowering standards, but you've got to make it broaden the base of it to find people who want to play. I guess my own conclusion is over, you know, 40 years since I joined the public service, I'm not too sure that public service, whether it's in the Department of Foreign Affairs, the military as a civilian, or in national defense, public service still holds the attraction for Canada's best and brightest. You know, the sense of service that maybe my generation had because my parents and uncles and all that were in the war, you know, at a time when public service was still deemed to be honorable, the political system still ran properly. I think a lot of people are now being turned off the idea of public service because they just see it as a big cesspool and not wanting to get involved. Now, not everybody can become a Bay Street banker, financier, or lawyer, whatever. But there are other options for really clever, capable people. And I'm not too sure that with some exceptions now, the public service or the military are attracting the best and brightest out of Canadian universities. When I joined the public service, I joined the public service initially under something called the Administrative Trainee Program, which the Federal Public Service Commission ran. And we were recruited from across the country as ATs, taken to Ottawa, and then we were assigned to a department through a second round of interviews. Yeah. And that year, the chairman of the Public Service Commission was a guy called John Carson. And he publicly proclaimed us, this was 1976, the cream of the crop of Canadian graduates joined the AT program that year. Well, I'm not too sure we would say that today. And don't get me wrong, there's still some good people joining and so on. But I'm not too sure the public service is able to attract the best and the brightest. And that's why, you know, the Chief of Defense Staff of the military has publicly said they've got to start looking elsewhere for people to recruit. Tough business. Well, and the case, you know, when the economy is going well, you know, our unemployment rates are the lowest they've been for a long, long time. There are other opportunities than public service, either in the civil service or in the military. So people tend to join.
The stability isn't recognized necessarily.
And the security the public service used to provide is no longer guaranteed either. Mm-hmm. You know, the pension system is changing, so no one longer gets a defined benefit pension at the end of your time and that type of thing. My son, when he came back from Afghanistan with his guys, he's in the infantry, all the guys were, you know, spent a few months hanging around barracks saying, well, what's next? Well, there was nothing next because we were pooped out from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We needed to renew. Well, they all went up to the northern Alberta to work in the oil sands. Mm-hmm. You know, $50,000 a year corporals were earning $120 driving a truck up north. When the oil sands went belly up several years ago, a lot of these guys came back to the Army and reenlisted. And they were taken in because they were trained soldiers.
Yeah.
So it's a different mosaic out there, different canvas.
Well, I guess we sort of are ending on a bit of a cynical note, but I mean, that's...
Well, no, it's a real... I don't think it sounds a bit cynical, but it's a real note, too, and we have to cope with all this stuff, and the challenges are pretty great. You know, in my day, when I had a choice of career. I went in the public service, but I consciously wanted to do it.
Right.
Not because it was last chance saloon or something like that.
Okay, well, anyway, David, thank you for that. And
okay, hope it helps in your work, and... when you have your other interviews, pull together some useful thoughts. I look forward to seeing your paper in due course.
Yes. Yeah, me too.
Okay, thanks, Harry. Fun.